Thank you, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here. And today I will speak about a piece of work we did in collaboration with my student Philip Zucker. And its subject is the nature of the quantum Hall state at the filling factor 5½. Now, I suspect that there are some people in the audience who think that that's a completely pointless subject, that the problem was solved long ago. What's the point? But then I also suspect that when I ask people who think so this audience is not very big. So maybe not all three points of view are going to be represented in this particular room. But generally, people who consider the problem to be solved give you one of the three answers. There is a school of thought that tells you that the problem was solved very long ago, and the answer is the Pfeiffian state. Then there is another school of thought that tells that the problem was solved more recently, and the answer is the anti-Pfeiffian state. Finally, there is a third school of thought that tells us that the problem wasn't fully solved, but the answer can only be one of two things, either Pfeiffian or anti-Pfeiffian. Yet, when we examine the evidence for all these three claims, we'll discover that it's not very strong. Let me put it this way. If the Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian states were on a criminal trial for being the 5½ quantum Hall liquid, no jury would find them guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Certainly, a civil trial where the standard is just preponderance of evidence is a different matter, but even there, they would only be found guilty because no one ever bothered to bring a serious case against another state. But that's what I'm going to do today, and I hope that by the end of my talk, I will convince you that you may not know what happens beyond reasonable doubt, but as far as preponderance of evidence is concerned, it's a different state. But before I arrive to that different state, I obviously need to make an introduction. So the talk will actually have a pretty long introduction. I will start with a review of quantum Hall effects, and I will proceed with the particular problem of the filling factor 5½, and I will have to speak about the Pfeiffian state, an important player in the game. And then the crucial part of the talk will be a discussion of experiment, and we'll see that the experiment actually kills that proposal. But then there is something else that nicely fits with all existing experiment, and that will be the last thing I want to discuss in this talk. But first, the basics. Now, the quantum Hall effect is an example of one phenomenon that was known for a very long time, some 130 years, the Hall effect. Now, what is the Hall effect? If you have just some electric field, we know how electrons move, the electric forces along the field, they follow the lines of the field. But if you also have a magnetic field, then there is an additional magnetic force that's perpendicular to the velocity of the electrons, so they no longer follow the lines of the electric field. That's it. That's the Hall effect. And now exactly this pretty simple and boring phenomenon was something that Glitzing, Droda, and Pepper were investigating in 1980 when they took a very thin, very high quality film of a semiconductor, placed it in a strong magnetic field perpendicular to the film, cooled it to a low temperature, and then, yes, indeed, they saw the Hall effect. But that was a very strange sort of the Hall effect, something quite unexpected. First of all, it was really an extreme version of the effect because they discovered that all current was flowing in the direction perpendicular to the electric field. There was no parallel component at all. That was interesting, but the most interesting thing was the relation between the current and the voltage. And at first sight, this relation is really nothing interesting. It's a linear law. It's like Ohm's law. So, well, that's what we usually expect. But then the coefficient, this conductance, it was really interesting because they discovered that it was made of three things. One is just a number, an integer number in their case, which depended on the magnetic field. In some interval of the magnetic field, it was one, then two, then three, so on, always an integer number. But the other two things were universal constants. They have the square of the charge of an electron and the Planck constant. That's a very interesting conductance, an integer times E squared divided by H. Now, certainly, if you play numerology games, you can fit anything with universal constants as long as you don't want a high accuracy. But their accuracy was incredible. They had at least 10 digits. And actually, no one knows how many digits they have because according to the Union of Pure and Applied Physics, it's now postulated that they had an infinite number of digits. Indeed, the Union of Pure and Applied Physics simply defines the ratio of E squared and H as whatever you see in this experiment. So that was very strange. And then Okay, if this were atomic physics or say high energy physics, it would be a different story. High energy physics is called fundamental physics for a reason. If you got something that's made only of fundamental constants there, then okay, well, that's what you expect in fundamental physics, but that's solid state physics. And in solid state physics, everything depends on everything. How big is your film? What is its shape? What material it is made of? How many impurities it has? Where? What type? How uniform is your magnetic field? What is its exact numerical value? Where are your electrical contacts? How you make them? And an infinite number of things. I don't know if we can even list all of them. All these people discover new things on which things depended, and they didn't even know that things depend on that before. Okay, so it's completely insane, and yet all you get is E squared divided by H. It's a complete miracle. And to make things even more incredible, what von Klitzing, Jordan, and Pepper discovered, that combination even has extremely simple and easy to remember numerical value. It's just one Klitzing who is shown in this picture. So it's a miracle. But on the theory side, that miracle turned out to be relatively simple to explain. What happened? It was possible to explain such universal conductance made of universal constants just from a very simple model of non-interacting electrons. And the only fact that was really essential was known since 1920s. So we know what happens with electrons when we place them in a uniform magnetic field. In empty space without a field, they would have some continuous spectrum from the first page of the quantum mechanics textbook. And then if you read it to, I don't know, page 200 or so, you would discover that a uniform magnetic field, the spectrum becomes discrete. It's made of what is called Landau levels. And when you know that, it turns out very simple to explain this phenomenon, and this integer number nu turns out to be just the number of the field Landau levels. That's it. So the physics was very simple. But then it was on the side of theory. The experiment didn't remain in the same state forever. Gradually, the semiconductor films improved, and then Tsu and Stormer observed something even more interesting. They actually observed something very similar, but now this coefficient nu stopped being an integer number. They observed a rational coefficient. The first one was one thought. By now, people know about 100 such rational coefficients. These are all numbers with small denominators, like one thought, two fifths, three fifths, four sevenths, and the famous filling factor of 5/2, but importantly, they are not integers, and that meant a huge crisis for theory, because the theory that existed at the time, it's just the beginning. Things will become much more serious later. So the theory that existed at the time was based on a model of non-interacting electrons, and one can actually prove if electrons don't interact, all you can get is an integer number here, and that's it. So now, on some level, it's probably not a surprise. Yes, people observe the non-integer nu, but then electrons interact, and they even interact strongly. So no miracle here, right? But the problem is, and that's something people like me actually don't want to admit, but I have to. Because condensed matter theorists like me are really just one or maybe two trick ponies. There are only two things we can do. One thing, and we love doing that thing, and that's what worked when nu was integer, is to pretend that electrons don't interact. This is really never well justified, but we pretend that anyway, and if we can account for some phenomenon with that trick, we are happy and tell that we explained it. It's always a lie, but that's what we do. If this trick fails, then we have another trick. We can do perturbation theory and include interaction perturbatively. But if this fails too, then we are helpless. And that's exactly what happened here. No one could explain the fractional quantum Hall effect, the phenomenon when nu was one third or two fifths or something like that. And one would think that that would be the end of my talk because no one knows what to do with that and we are stuck there. But then Laughlin came and did something absolutely incredible. Not only he solved the problem, and this required a real non-perturbative solution of a problem of many interacting electrons, he even did it with extraordinary simple approach. His approach was, well, I never read a simple paper in theoretical physics. He simply guessed the correct ground state wave function when the filling factor is one third. That was it. That's all his solution. If we only could do this with all problems. And now, after he guessed the correct ground state wave function, he certainly knew a lot about the state. He could explain the observed conductance by its one sort of E square divided by H and so on. But all most interesting questions are not about the ground state. All most interesting questions are about excited states. So what are the properties of low-lying excitations? That is quasi-particles. And what Laughlin discovered, they were absolutely crazy. Remember, our system is made of electrons. So one would think that you need to combine a few electrons to get excitations. So their electric charge may be one electron charge, or two, or three, maybe zero if they're neutral. But what Laughlin discovered was completely different. It turned out that the charge was actually fractional. Elementary excitations on his state with nu equal 1/3 carries a charge of 1/3 of an electron. So that was crazy, but that was actually the less crazy thing about those quasiparticles. A much more interesting discovery was made by Arovas, Schrieffer, and Wilczek, and it concerns their statistics. And now every quantum mechanics textbook explains us that there are two different sorts of statistics in quantum mechanics. It can be bosons, and we know that nothing happens to bosons when we exchange their positions, or these can be fermions, and they change their wave functions when we exchange their positions. So this is a statement you find in the books. What you never find is a good explanation. A typical textbook would not explain this at all, but proclaims that that's a law of nature. And there is a good reason why they never explain that. It's because it's simply not true. The truth is that there are three possibilities. One possibility is that you exchange two particles and nothing happens. Then these are bosons. Or you can exchange two particles and change the sign of wave function. Then it's fermions. Or you can exchange two particles and absolutely anything else happens other than these two possibilities. That's the third possibility, and the particles that satisfy this third possibility are known as anions, because, well, literally anything can happen. Now, but why then quantum mechanics textbooks hide their existence? The reason is very simple. For a very long time, no single anion was ever observed in the nature. And then it changed, because Arovas, Schrieffer, and Wilczek showed that these very particles of fractional charge are also anions. When you exchange them, the wave function picks up some non-trivial phase, which is not zero or pi. Okay, so these are really crazy particles, but I am actually very, very, very far from my topic, from the filling factor 5/2. I am speaking about the filling factor 1/3. What Laughlin did in that case could be very easily generalized to many other filling factors, in fact, to all filling factors with an odd denominator. And for a long time, people thought that that's all you need, because all experimentally observed filling factors for some time were only filling factors with odd denominators. Even in principle emerged that that's the only sort of filling factor that was possible, because, well, that was the only thing people saw experimentally, and actually the only sort of thing they could imagine explaining theoretically. And then Bob Pivet and collaborators observed something that went absolutely beyond common wisdom. They observed a quantum Hall state with a conductance which was 5/2 of E square over H. And that was a new crisis, so there are many crises in this story. But eventually Moore and Reed came with a potential beautiful explanation of that particular state. So what they invented is known as the Pfaffian state, and this name refers to the mathematical object Pfaffian, which is a part of their wave function, but I don't want to speak about the wave functions they wrote as a possible ground state, because this ground state will not play much role in my story. What's going to play significant role is the nature of quasiparticles again, and these quasiparticles are certainly anions, as always, and their charge is fractional, as always, but the charge is nothing surprising. In this particular case, it's 1/4 of an electron. What's really interesting is statistics, because their statistics is fundamentally different from what happened in Laughlin's case. So they are more different from Laughlin's particles than those particles differ from fermions and bosons. And the reason is that they exhibit what's called non-abelian statistics, as opposed to the abelian statistics of fermions, bosons, and Laughlin's anions. So when I was speaking about Laughlin's particles, I defined them in essentially the same way I defined fermions and bosons. I told that one particle goes around another and picks up some phase. In fact, if one particle just makes a full circle around another, then fermions and bosons would not pick up any phase. Going in a circle is the same as exchanging particles twice. For fermions and for bosons, this would not change the wave function. For Laughlin's anions, this would change the wave function. But what's crucial, it would not change the quantum state. Multiplying a wave function by a number is extremely subtle operation. You don't really change any physics. You are still in the same quantum state exactly. It's just a different way to represent it. So we are speaking about something extremely subtle. What happens in the Pfaffian state is dramatically different. One particle goes around another, and then your quantum state is different. It's not just a function, it's really a quantum state. And what this means that you don't actually know what your quantum state is, even if you fixed all the positions of quasiparticles and all their internal quantum numbers. So all quantum numbers you have, the position, spin, everything is fixed, and yet you don't know what your quantum state is. In the case of the Pfaffian state, for two particles at fixed points of space, there are still two different quantum states. And you cannot distinguish them locally, but globally they are very different. You just run one particle around another and see what phase you accumulate. And you see that you get two different phases and two different states. So it's a very strange sort of a system called non-abelian. And now, one of the reasons why this very unusual proposal attracted a lot of attention has to do with quantum computing, because at some point people realized that this sort of quantum non-local degeneracy is very good for quantum computing, but I am not going to speak about quantum computation in this talk, because there are very many ideas I need to introduce, and if I can cut something from this talk, I am going to cut it. So I will not speak about this. Okay, anyway, that's where we are. That's a very nice theoretical proposal. But does this proposal actually describe what happens in the nature? That's a difficult question. Part of the reason is what are other alternative proposals. As it turns out, there are many of them. It was hard to come with the first theory, but after it was invented, new theories emerged just like mushrooms after the rain. Because people could see what the structure of this Pfaffian-Moritz state is and just use its features for other theories. And then they looked at the ground state wave function, which I didn't write here. They discovered that it's essentially the same as the wave function of electrons in the BCS theory of superconductivity. And this immediately explained everything. Because what's the problem with Laughlin theory? Laughlin theory only works for odd denominators of filling factors, but this happens because electrons are fermions. If they were bosons, it would be the other way around. It would be very easy to explain even denominators, but impossible to explain odd denominators. But now it's not hard to make a boson out of electrons. You just Cooper pairs them, and Cooper pairs are bosons. And so what you do, you have a Laughlin state of Cooper pairs. That's exactly what Moore and Reed did, but then every expert on superconductivity knows that there are very many ways to build Cooper pairs. Sometimes different ways matter even in the same material. For example, liquid helium-3 exhibits two different types of Cooper pairs in its A phase and B phase. And here, it turns out that it's particularly easy to produce very different sorts of Cooper pairs, so various competing theories proliferated. What's listed here is not even a complete set. There are other theories that didn't fit my transparency. So there are very many ways. They are all similar in their basic features. They are all Laughlin states of Cooper pairs. They all predict exactly the same electrical resistance. They all predict exactly the same charge of quasiparticles, one quarter of the electron, but they all predict different statistics. Some are abelian, others are non-abelian, and there is a huge variety in both groups. So which one is correct? Well, physics is an experimental science, so the answer seems obvious. You just look at what experiment tells you, and what it tells you, that's what happens in the nature. Other theories may be nice, but they are wrong. Unfortunately, for a very long time, this didn't work, because very little was known from experiment. And in such situation, people focused on numerics. And very gradually, numerics led to a conclusion that the two states with the lowest energy, the lowest ground state energy, are Pfaffian and a closely related anti-Pfaffian state. The experts know that this anti doesn't mean that the state is the exact opposite of Pfaffian. It's actually a very close relative. So that's what numeric told us. And in the absence of any other evidence, well, obviously we have to tell that, okay, our best evidence points at Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian. We cannot solve the problem beyond reasonable doubt without experiment, but as far as our civil trial goes, as far as the preponderance of evidence standard, it's clear that it's one of these two things. But what I would like to emphasize, all this numerical evidence wasn't very strong from the very beginning. And the quantitative measure of its weakness comes from the numerical energy gap. So what is energy gap here? So I spoke about anions, but it always costs some energy to create an anion. That energy cost is known as the energy gap. And the energy gap was one of very few numbers that experimentalists could easily supply. And so you could compare this with numerical results for the energy gap in the Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian states, and the comparison turned out to be disastrous. Universally, the numerical energy gap is many times higher than whatever you measure experimentally. So that's very bad agreement, which raises questions. Okay, what's going on? Actually, the answer why this happens is believed to be known. The problem is that numerics involves many approximations. There are really very many of them, but two are believed to be particularly important. One approximation is that numerics always neglects disorder. Disorder is actually pretty significant in those samples. We call them very clean, but you always need a measure of cleanness. So they actually, disorder is strong enough that you should not neglect it, otherwise you can have no hope to get the correct energy gap, and it's neglected because no one knows how to include it. And then there is another thing, so-called Landau level mixing. Now, as we discussed in the very beginning, the crucial part of the story is Landau levels. And now there is an infinite number of Landau levels, and in principle, all of them matter, but it's very hard to deal with an infinite Hilbert space. So what numerical people tend to do, they place all electrons just into a single Landau level. This greatly improves the possibilities. They can deal with many more electrons than in a more generic setting. But this approximation is not necessarily valid. Its validity depends on what we call as a Landau level mixing parameter. And if this parameter is much smaller than one, then this is an excellent approximation. If this parameter is greater than one, then this approximation is simply wrong. Now, typically in experiments at the filling factor 5.5, this parameter is around 1.3. So the approximation is just wrong. Yes?
How do you experimentally
measure the it's defined as the ratio of the Coulomb energy and the cyclotron gap. So both of them are easily known, because if you know the distance between electrons, you automatically know the typical Coulomb interaction. And if you know what your magnetic field is and the mass of carriers, then you know whatever you want to know about the energy gap. Okay. So this parameter is known as very high accuracy. It just varies from sample to sample. It's never below 0.7 in this game, even in extreme cases, which means that the approximation is never valid really. And this is certainly a very nice way to explain why there is such huge discrepancy of the experimental and numerical gaps. But how you interpret this discrepancy and this explanation depends on the degree of your optimism. If you're an optimist, and I think most scientists are optimists, it's very hard to do science otherwise, right? If you're an optimist, you tell, well, okay, yes, certainly this explains why the numerical results for the energy gap are so bad. But there's not a reason to doubt that the qualitative conclusion about the nature of quasi-particles, the topological order, is wrong. No, that's all fine. And when we find a way to include these in the simulations, then everything will be in order. But if you're a pessimist, as I gradually became, then you tell, well, okay, you just put a Hamiltonian into your computer, and this Hamiltonian has nothing to do with your system, so how do you know that any conclusions are correct at all? The gap is definitely absolutely wrong. But I actually must admit that I became a pessimist very gradually. I was in the optimist camp until I realized that there is a major problem with the ground state energies of competing states. Because the gap energy is the difference of the ground state energy and the lowest excited state. But you can also ask, okay, what's the energy difference for various competing ground states per a single electron? If this number were many, many times higher than the gap, I would tell, okay, all these effects certainly change the gap a lot, but what can they do with this huge difference of ground state energies? Unfortunately, that's not what happens. It turns out that the difference of the ground state energies for Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian and other competing states is still on the order of the same energy gap. So any mechanism that can change the energy gap can also change what state is the ground state. So we really know nothing. And recent attempts to improve that, recent attempts to include Landau level mixing and simulation didn't help too much, because no one can do it in a controllable way. All people can do is perturbation theory, and perturbation theory with a small parameter 1.3 really is not working. And so what happened was the agreement, this experiment actually decreased. The best state of the art numerical work now predicts that in experimentally relevant parameters, there should not be any quantum Hall effect with a filling factor of 5.5. That's where we are with numerics now. So that's it's a problem. Yet, if you have no experiment and all you have is numerics, you have no choice but to conclude there's probably Pfaffian or anti-Pfaffian because there is no evidence for anything else. But what's very important, what changed during the last 5 years, we now have experiment. And as I'm going to argue, this experiment actually excludes the Pfaffian and closely related anti-Pfaffian states. And the first important piece of the experiment is the observation of so-called upstream neutral modes. Now, as I mentioned many times in the previous transparency, there is an energy gap in the story. But the energy gap is normally associated with insulators. And these systems obviously conduct electricity. So how does this happen? This happens because there is no gap on the edges of the sample. And we know that the electric current flows along those edges. And a very interesting feature of the quantum Hall effect is that this current is chiral. It flows in exactly one direction, say clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on your system. We call that direction downstream. Now, clearly, if the current can flow in some direction, then it can also carry energy, and so it can also flow in the same direction. But it may also happen that the energy flows also in the opposite direction. Then we tell that the energy is carried by an upstream neutral mode. Neutral because it doesn't carry current, only energy, and upstream because it goes against the direction of the current. And we know that there are two sorts of neutral modes in real systems. Some of them are so-called topologically protected modes. Topologically protected modes must be present on the edges of every sample at a given filling factor. They are simply dictated by the properties of the bulk. No matter what you do with the edge, you cannot eliminate that upstream neutral mode. It's always there. And then there is a second sort of upstream neutral modes. They emerge to what we call, due to what we call edge reconstruction. So you do something to the edge and you get that mode, but then you do something else, it disappears. It's not protected by the bulk physics. So these are two possibilities. And we also know that they look very differently experimentally. All this is recent knowledge. So the relevant experiments were performed between 2010 and very recently. So what we know, these two sorts of modes behave very differently in experiments. Upstream neutral modes, which are not topologically protected, that emerge due to what we call edge reconstruction, can propagate to only very short distances. Even at the lowest available temperatures, around 10 millikelvin, this would be just few microns. But topologically protected modes propagate to a much longer scale, which is about an order of magnitude longer, say 80 microns or something. And so one can very clearly tell when you have edge reconstruction and when one has topological protection. Theoretical reasons for this difference are also well understood, but they are not important for my talk. It's enough that we have this empirical principle. And so a natural question is, okay, so what happens at the filling factor 5.5? And as Moti Hybrim showed, the propagation length at the filling factor 5.5 is long. Hence, yes?
Why should the topological modes have just
oh, well, you always lose energy. There are all sorts of dissipative mechanisms. But your question is excellent, because if the temperature were zero, they would propagate and propagate and propagate. It's only the finite temperature that kills them. So when you cool the system enough, they propagate for a very long distance. And that's how we distinguish them from modes that are not protected and always have a finite propagation distance, even at zero temperature. So that's the whole point. Yeah, so thank you for the question. Anyway, the bottom line is that we do have a topologically protected neutral mode on the edge of a 5.5 system. Now, what does this mean? This immediately excludes the Pfaffian state because it has no such mode, but a closely related anti-Pfaffian state has such mode, so, well, probably it is a solution. In fact, for some time I mentioned three camps in the beginning of the talk. For a long time, I was in the second camp that believes there's anti-Pfaffian state based on the combination of numerics with this experiment. But then another experiment came, which made things even worse. So this experiment is a tunneling experiment. So I mentioned that the current flows along the edges of a quantum Hall liquid. So in this picture, white is the quantum Hall liquid, and then there is no quantum Hall liquid under these shaded areas. So there are two edges. But what I told is not completely true, because if you bring two edges very close to each other, then charge can tunnel between them, so you have some tunneling current here. And then Shaogang Quan, who is associated with this institute, very long ago, he made a wonderful prediction that this experiment is actually the only thing you need to do if you want to know the nature of the quantum Hall state. Because his prediction was that at low temperature, the conductance is the power of the temperature, and this number G in the conductance tells you about the nature of the quantum Hall state. It's a universal number, you know it, you know everything. Well, unfortunately, as it happens all too often, it's not how things work in the experiment. Invariably, at all feeling factors, all groups get numbers which are greater than what is the universal number predicted by Wendt's theory. And the difference is often huge. 2 times, even 3 times happens, so it's a big difference. It's the same story, essentially, as the comparison of numerical and experimental gaps. The difference may be not as bad as for the gaps, says typically 2 times, but it's still very bad. Now, one would think that this makes all that completely useless. Well, in some way, yes, but the truth is it's not completely useless. We understand that, yes, certainly Wendt's theory disregards dissipation, disregards Coulomb interaction across these gates, it disregards edge reconstruction, all these 3 mechanisms inevitably increase G, that's why it's always greater than what one tells, and so you cannot really measure the G and tell what the universal G is, but you can tell something, because all these mechanisms always increase G, because every experiment always invariably shows that G is greater than what Wendt predicts, what you measure experimentally is an upper bound on what should happen in an ideal sample that behaves according to Wendt's theory. So you don't know what G is, but you know what G isn't. It cannot be greater than what is measured experimentally. That's not much, but that's something. And when we compare that something with what is known about Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian state, we discover that the measure G excludes the anti-Pfeiffian state. The theoretical G in the anti-Pfeiffian state is already too big, and we know that one can easily expect some 50% or 100% addition due to all these mechanisms I listed. So it's way too big. Pfeiffian state is fine. It's compatible with this experiment. And in fact, a big number of other proposed states are compatible with this experiment. So what happens is actually very curious. This experiment excludes about 50% of the numerous proposed states. The same happens with the experiment on upstream modes. There are very many proposed states. About half of them have upstream modes and half don't. And so only half of them are excluded. But then when you look at this experiment and the previous one, you see that both of them exclude half of the proposed states, but these are 2 different halves. After these 2 experiments are combined, nothing is left at all. So we have a lot of theories, but all of them are wrong. So it's a very bad situation. Now, what conclusion should we make here? We make the conclusion that, well, apparently all theories are wrong, or maybe something is wrong with the experiment, but that's a very troubling situation. Anyway, the only states for which we have evidence are still Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian, because that's what numerics supports. So we probably should tell that by preponderance of evidence it's probably Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian, but we really don't know what happens. Yes.
So for this
tunneling
experiment, how do you think about the edge reconstruction?
Edge reconstruction always increases G. So there are 3 mechanisms. Each of them increases G. We know that. So dissipation, Coulomb interaction, edge reconstruction, they all increase G. But based on the data I know, typically it is Coulomb interaction that's the main mechanism. Because, for example, in the feeling factor 5.5, there were 3 different values of G shown, obtained by 3 different groups, and they claim that they support 2 different quantum Hall states. Then you look at their devices, and you see that the highest G corresponded to the narrowest gate, hence to the strongest Coulomb repulsion. Also, at the feeling factor 1/3, people see how G changes when they change the gate voltage. And again, it turns out that they can almost get what theory predicts when they select the gate voltage in the way that minimizes Coulomb repulsion, and they get something that's 3 times worse than the theory in the opposite limit. But yes, edge reconstruction is there. It was analyzed by, I think the first were Halpern and Rosenow, and then later Kuhn Yang considered a different scenario. It also always increases G. Dissipation does that, Coulomb repulsion does that. So we have more theoretical explanations than phenomena here. There is only one phenomenon. G is always greater than what theory predicts in all states where we know what G is supposed to be. And theoretically, we have 3 different mechanisms. Probably all 3 might work, but it doesn't matter too much. There is an empirical rule here. That's on what I rely. Yes?
Is the increase in G also as much for the integer fillings?
Surprisingly, I don't know the data for integer filling, so I cannot answer your question. There is surprisingly little data about this stuff. So recently, almost all data, probably 40% of the data is at the filling factor of 5.5. That's the factor that attracted a lot of attention. So people did some experiments on one sort. They saw that G was 2 times higher than what's needed. Then there were theories. Then everyone forgot about that because the experiment was declared useless. Then people forgot that it's useless, began doing it at 5.5, got different numbers in different rooms, began digging it, did experiments at 8, sorts at 7, sorts, began doing that at 1 sort again, and saw that it's always greater than what theory predicts, and then they realized, well, but theories told us that long ago. So everything is useless at 5.5. What I'm telling, it's not useless. It's the upper bound. But I cannot answer your question about the integer filling factors. Integer filling factors are in many ways more stable, so, but I cannot tell you what happens. Okay. Anyway, now we excluded all states. So maybe that's the end of my talk. Nothing is left, right? But there's no doubt. Recently, Damson did a very beautiful piece of work that opened a way to solve this paradox. His work was actually not about the filling factor 5.5 at all. It was about the filling factor 1.5, so I probably need to speak a little bit about that too. So filling factor 1.5 is very different from everything I discussed before because there is no quantum Hall state there. The state is actually compressible, there is no gap, and it behaves pretty, in many ways, just like Fermi liquid. And there was an old beautiful theory by Harper and Lee and Reed that explained all experiments that existed at that time, so the problem seemed to be solved. They introduced a very beautiful picture of what they called composite fermions, and then it turned out that those composite fermions form something very similar to the Landau Fermi liquid. So everything seemed to be understood. There was one theoretical issue with their work, because experimentally, the filling factor 1.5 is, well, it's not, it doesn't really have the particle Hall symmetry, but it's pretty close to having it. And their theory badly violates that symmetry. But as long as there was no experimental evidence against the theory, people didn't take that issue too seriously. And then in 2014, Princeton's group actually got evidence that contradicted the theory by Harper and Lee and Reed. So something had to be done. And then Swan came and made a conjecture that the theory actually has particle Hall symmetry, and in order to realize that symmetry, one needs to assume that those composite fermions are relativistic Dirac particles. And when you do that, you can explain all experiments that Harper and Lee and Reed could explain, plus the new experiments, and you solve the theoretical issue of the particle Hall symmetry. So that was a very beautiful piece of work. And the focus of his work was certainly on the filling factor 1.5, on the filling factor 1.5, but he had a very, very brief discussion of what might happen at the filling factor 5.5, because he solved another major theoretical issue. So I listed you a very huge collection of various possible ways to build Cooper pairs. But people who do superconductivity know that you don't normally consider a huge number of candidates for a particular superconductor. There are exceptions, there are debates about some more exotic superconductors, but normally you always know what happens. The simplest possible thing happens, what we call S-pairing. Why we have so many candidates at the filling factor 5.5? One of the reasons was that no one ever succeeded to build a wave function with S-pairings there, until Sohn came and told that, okay, you can build a new state, which is just made of S-pairs of Dirac fermions. So that's the simplest possible thing you could introduce at the filling factor 5.5, and we always respect when the solution is particularly simple. So it was nice, but the problem is that his solution wasn't quite a solution. So he told that, okay, I have Dirac fermions, and I can build S pairs of them, and I will get the correct filling factor. But he could not tell much about the properties of that state, because his Dirac fermions are actually a conjecture. This conjecture nicely explains the experiment at the filling factor 1.5, but he cannot write a wave function for the Dirac fermions. No one quite knows what they are. They are very strange objects. And if you have something whose wave function you don't have, it's very hard to build Cooper pairs of these objects. You also cannot write down the wave function. So Sohn could not compare his proposal with experiment and tell if it makes sense. And that's actually what Philip Zucker and me did. And I finally began a serious discussion of the original part of my story. And now, we could not obviously start from these Dirac fermions because we also don't know what they are. Instead, we discuss that will start with symmetry, because look at this name, pH Pfaffian state, that's how Son called it. pH stands for particle hole symmetry. So we decided to see what restrictions the particle hole symmetry imposes on the topological order. And there are quite a few of them, but what was important for us, it fixes what the electrical conductance is, and it fixes it at the correct experimentally observed value. And second, it fixes what the thermal conductance is. Next. When you know electrical and thermal conductance, you might try to ask, what exactly is the edge theory that corresponds to my state? Because we know that the energy and charge don't really flow in the bulk. They flow along the edges. So if I am interested in the low energy physics, there must be some low energy effective theory that produces the correct electrical conductance and the correct thermal conductance. And the only one we could write down is this one. So it's a very simple theory, actually. It has two components. One is the Bose field. It carries the electrical charge. And the other is some fermion field, actually neutral fermion fields, or Majorana fermions. You see that this fermion equals its own creation and annihilation operators are the same. So these are Majoranas. And it can carry energy but no charge, and it flows in the direction opposite to that of the Bose field. So you have plus sign here, which fixes downstream direction, and the minus sign here, which fixes the upstream direction for this fermion. So it's a pretty simple theory. It has the correct electrical conductance and the correct thermal conductance. And so that's our definition of this pH Pfaffian state. Now, the moment you have the edge theory, you can tell pretty much everything, because there is a trick in the game, for example. It's called the bulk edge correspondence. So if you know the bulk wave function, you can write down the effective theory on the edge. But you can go in the opposite direction and write various examples of the bulk wave functions for a given topological order if you have the edge theory. And a very schematic representation of the appropriate ground state wave function is shown here, but I ask you not to take it too seriously. First of all, the real equation is longer, and I shortcut it, it actually has wrong dimensions here. But second, I will not really use that. This edge theory, however, is very important for me. And one part of the story that I can extract from this edge theory, again, with pretty standard prescriptions, is what sort of quasi-particles I have. And actually, even if the name pH Pfaffian promises, what I get is very similar to the Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian state, though not exactly the same. It's a different state, different statistics. The charge is the same, as always, E over 4, but it is the same for all 10 or so competing states. That's no surprise. And the statistics is non-abelian. This is a difference from many candidates, but certainly not a difference from Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian. So as far as quantum computing goes, no changes. Finally, the nature of this non-abelian statistics is in some way the same as in the Pfaffian state. As you can see, this transparency is really a replica of the transparency I had for the Pfaffian state, but with one important modification. In the Pfaffian state, I considered states of two identical particles and told that when I fix their positions, I get two degenerate states that differ by the phases accumulated when particles run around each other. What I have to modify here, now I put a particle as antiparticle here. This has minus charge, and this has plus charge. And then when I fix their positions, I again have two degenerate states with exactly the same phases when they run around each other. So it's very similar. It's not the same, but it's very similar. Yes? Oh, so this is a plus charge. This plus charge is somewhat different. It's still degenerate. I still have two different states, but now the phases are different and not as neat. Zero and pi is very neat. Now you would get some less neat phases. That's the only difference. But fundamentally, it's very similar. It's not the same non-abelian statistics, but that's a relative. And importantly, it's also non-abelian. Okay. Now, in fact, I need to go into somewhat more depth explaining what the statistics is and list all possible quasi-particles that I mentioned in the theory. There are six classes. They are labeled by two numbers. One is the electric charge. And the other is a so-called topological charge, which is just a label, 1, psi, or sigma. So its physical meaning will be clear momentarily. So if the label is sigma, there are two possibilities for the electric charge. It's plus or minus E over 4. This is exactly the plus and minus from my previous transparency. Now, if the label is 1 or the label is psi, then the electric charges are either 0 or E over 2, half of the electron. And the meaning of 1 and psi is very simple. If the charge is 0 and I just have 1, it's nothing. It's neutral boson. And if I have psi and zero charge, it's a neutral fermion. Sigma is trickier, and to understand what sigma is, I need to introduce another piece of the story, so-called fusion rules. What happens when I combine two anions? Electrical charges certainly add. That's no big deal. But what happens with these labels, with the topological charges? Well, for psi, we know what happens. Two fermions give a boson. When you combine psi and sigma, you get sigma. But when you combine two sigma, something very funny happens. You don't know what you get. You may get a boson or you may get a fermion. That's where the fact that the statistics known is non-abelian shows up. And finally, the third important piece of information is what we call braiding rules. What exactly happens when one particle goes around another? What are the phases? There are very many such braiding rules because there are very many pairs of particles you can consider, and I don't have enough space on this transparency to list them all, but more importantly, it's probably pointless. By the time we need them, everyone will forget them anyway. So I skip that part. And instead, I finally come to the crucial part of this talk where I compare the properties of the pH Pfaffian state with the experiment. And the comparison is very easy. First of all, I do have an upstream neutral mode in agreement with this experiment. Indeed, that's the very definition of my edge theory. These two modes run in the opposite directions, so I can transport energy in both directions. That's fine. What about tunneling? Again, the same story. It turns out that the tunneling exponent satisfies the experimental upper bound. So I'm also fine with the tunneling experiments. There are many other experiments. For example, people measured the charge or the conductance and so on. But unfortunately, those experiments are not very useful to discriminate different states. Typically, they show the same exactly things for all states. And in particular, they would show exactly the same for Pfaffian, anti-Pfaffian, and the pH Pfaffian state. So perhaps the right approach for me would be just to skip the discussion of other experiments, but I think one of them I do need to discuss very briefly. It's a so-called topological even-odd effect in the Aronoff-Bohm interferometry. Now, just like most other experiments, this one is actually not good to distinguish different states, and most states in my table would show the topological even-odd effect, but this point is not broadly known for some reason. A lot of people think that's a smoking gun experiment, so that's one reason why I want briefly to discuss that thing, but more importantly, I will speak about a different interferometry experiment that really distinguishes the pH Pfaffian state from everything else, and so this discussion will be useful as a warming up exercise. Now, I spoke already about tunneling through a single tunneling contact, but one can build a device with two tunneling contacts here and here, and when one does so, well, obviously, quasi-particles can tunnel from between the edges here and between the edges here. What it means? It means that I built an interferometer. Indeed, if I emit my quasi-particles from here, they can travel this way and end up in this drain. Or they can take this road, tunnel here, come back, and again end up in this drain. So I have two different ways to arrive to the same point. And as always in quantum mechanics, these two trajectories allow quantum interference. And now we are dealing with a system in a strong magnetic field. So clearly, the magnetic field affects what we see. And when you change the magnetic field, the current actually oscillates because the Aronoff-Bohm phase accumulated by the particles depends on the field and it changes. But the crucial prediction is that there is another thing that affects the phase. That's the number of the quasi-particles localized inside this device. If it's even, then you see interference and you see oscillations as a function of the magnetic field. But when it's odd, an interesting interplay of braiding and fusion rules makes it impossible to see any interference in the Pfaffian state. So that was a famous prediction from 2006. It's a pretty old prediction. It's unclear if it was verified experimentally. Bob Willett has experiments where he claims that he saw that. Some people believe that he did see that effect. Others don't believe him, so no one really knows how to interpret his data. But what I would like to emphasize, even if what he sees is a topological even-odd effect, and it may well be, it's not useful to discriminate different proposed states because the anti-Pfaffian state will show exactly the same behavior. The pH Pfaffian state would show exactly the same behavior. And what is Less known, even many of the abelian states, for example, the 3-3-1 state or the 1-1-3 state, would still show the same behavior. So, well, this topological even-odd effect is something that's supposed to happen pretty much in every competing theory. So this experiment is not useful. But these two are useful, and it seems that they select the PHP Pfeiffian state. Yet it's always dangerous just to rely on old experiments. It's always very good to propose some new experiments that could distinguish what you think is the solution of the problem from everything else. And so at the end of my talk, I want to discuss such new experiments. One possibility is look at the thermal conductance, but the really interesting thing is a different interference experiment, which is known as the Mach-Zehnder interferometry. And now what's shown here is certainly an artistic vision of a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, interferometers that people actually make. Don't look as beautiful, so I thought I better show this picture. Essentially, it's the same device as the Aronov-Bohm interferometer from the previous picture. So you have particles that arrive from here, then they can tunnel here, make a circle, and disappear in this drain, or alternatively, they go here, tunnel in this tunneling contact, and then again disappear in the drain. Again, there is interference between two trajectories, and again, the phase of that interference depends on the magnetic flux through the device because of the Aronov-Bohm effect. But there is an interesting twist here. The device has strange topology. This drain 2 is right in the middle of the device. The result is that after each tunneling event, when a quasiparticle is absorbed by this drain, its topological charge is left inside the device. Now, if we were dealing with fermions or bosons, this would not matter. They don't carry any topological charge. But non-abelian states do carry that topological charge. And now we know that when one particle runs around another particle, it accumulates a phase. So the result is that the topological charge sitting inside this drain affects the phase difference between two trajectories. And hence, it affects the probability of the tunneling event for the next quasiparticle. And after it tunnels, a different topological charge arrives here, so the probability changes again, and so on, and so on, so on. So it's an interesting device. It constantly changes its own tunneling probability. And now to make long story short, and I will provide a brief explanation how this comes, we make two predictions. One prediction is very depressing, actually. We predict that there is no interference at all when you use this device and measure the electrical resistance. It simply doesn't depend on the magnetic field. You're always in the wrong part of this even-odd effect. It is as if you always had an odd number of particles inside. But when you measure the fluctuations of the current, that's an opposite. Not only you see interference, but this becomes insane. At some values of the magnetic field, you literally see infinite noise. So that's our predictions. These two things don't appear compatible, but that's what happens. No interference in the current, huge interference in the noise. Okay, now, how do we get these results? So what one really needs to do, one needs to understand what the tunneling probability is, and that's not hard. So the tunneling probability is made of three things. One is the tunneling probability, assuming that we just have one tunneling contact here, so it's a square of the appropriate amplitude. The other tunneling probability, the second part of the tunneling probability comes from the second tunneling contact. And the really interesting part is the interference piece, where you multiply two tunneling amplitudes, and then you have some phases here. This alpha is very boring, just the phase difference of gamma 1 and gamma 2. I probably should have skipped it. Phi AB, as its name suggests, is the Aronov-Bohm phase due to the magnetic field. And the interesting part is the statistical phase, which comes from the total topological charge accumulated inside the interferometer. And now you can combine all that and make this strange diagram, which actually shows transitions between different states of the drain inside the interferometer. So they can have some electric charge, and what's more important, some topological charge. And then, for example, if your topological charge is vacuum and a single quasiparticle tunnels, then what you get is a state whose topological charge is sigma. With electrical charges, it's very simple. It's just like a clock. Every tunneling event just increases the total charge that went through the device by E over 4. It's not interesting. But the topological charge here changes by sigma. On the other hand, if your initial state has a topological charge sigma, you don't know what happens. There is a probability to become to get a fermionic topological charge or a bosonic topological charge. Both things can happen. That's why you have this intersection in the diagram. And now you can use this formula to understand what are the transition probabilities corresponding to all these arrows. So I label them as P0, P pi, and so on, where this index simply states for the value of the statistical phase. And then you know everything. You can write down the kinetic equations. There are many of them, but you can solve them. And eventually you get something really bad. The current doesn't depend on the magnetic field. Now, it's certainly a very striking prediction. I'm not aware of any other state of matter where something like that was predicted. But the problem is that it's not very useful experimentally, because nothing is easier to confirm experimentally than this thing. Only you would never know, do you see the striking signature, or is just your experiment not working? Yes?
Is there predicted dependence
for the Pfaffian state? There is a very strong dependence on the current, on the magnetic field. For the anti-Pfaffian, it's the same, essentially. Well, certainly there are prefactors which no one knows, but to the extent you can describe it from topological information, they are exactly the same for Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian.
So that would distinguish?
That would certainly distinguish, but this experiment, unfortunately, is useless, because the main thing from which you want to distinguish is not Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian, because in the real life on experimentalists, you constantly fight something very different from this lofty matters we theorists are thinking about. The main thing to distinguish is all states, whatever they are, Pfaffian, anti-Pfaffian, pH, Pfaffian, 1, 1, 3, whatever they are from, my experiment is not working. And when you see no interference, 99% of that's your experiment not working. So when my prediction is, well, you should not see any interference, I don't think any experimentalist is going to be happy. Well, I can tomorrow show you no interference, you know? That's very easy, nothing is easier.
The experiment actually there's no interference that has ever been observed.
Right. It's very hard to observe interference. They make a device, it shows no interference, they don't publish anything. Then the next year they make a different device, it suddenly shows interference if you just adjust it to a certain particular regime. Then they publish a paper, then they make 10 more devices, they don't show interference, they publish nothing. So okay, I don't know, maybe this prediction makes all stuff they didn't publish publishable, but I doubt. So they never see interference, it's an exception. So prediction like that is not useful, unfortunately. So you need to do something else. And that something else is the fluctuations of the current. So the formal definition is shown here, but when the current is weak, it's very convenient to rewrite it as the product of the average current and what we call the Fan effector, or perhaps more correctly, the effective charge. And this name reflects the physical meaning of this Fan effector when you have a single tunneling contact, because that's then just the charge of your current carriers. In fact, that's how Walter Schottky measured the charge of the electron in 1917. He just made a vacuum bulb, heated to a high temperature so that some electrons would travel through the empty space, but very few of them, and then measured the fluctuation. Then he divided it by the current and got the charge of the electron. The same exactly technique was used to first discover particles whose charge was 1/3 of the electron and to discover particles whose charge is 1/4 of the electron in this story. So that's a very time-honored technique, but what I suggest to do, it with the Mach Zehnder interferometer when you have two tunneling contacts. When you have two contacts, such simple interpretation no longer applies. What you see is no longer the carrier charge, you see something more complicated, and in general it can depend on the magnetic field through the device, so it's a complicated thing. But at the end of the day, you can just solve the kinetic equations, and now it really becomes a serious exercise. It requires some technical effort to solve it. For the noise, it's much harder than for the current, but then you get a reward. You get some non-trivial result, which actually shows non-trivial oscillation, so it's something. And it's not just something. Look at this sum of 1 divided by the probabilities. And the expressions for the probabilities are shown here. Now, if you build a symmetric device where gamma 1 equals gamma 2, then for appropriate values of the magnetic field, one of the probabilities may come very close to 0. So this noise would just show a huge spike for a particular magnetic field. And then such spikes would repeat periodically. So that's our prediction. There is a very simple qualitative explanation for this crazy behavior, how the noise becomes infinite, but I look at the clock and I feel that unless there are questions, I will not explain what the reason is, and instead we'll proceed to my closing argument, which I also will try to keep very brief. So I hope that I convince you that the Pfeiffian and anti-Pfeiffian state are occluded by the experiment. On the other hand, the pH Pfeiffian state seems to be compatible with all experiments we have. And so I'm not claiming that this is the state that describes the five half-lived beyond reasonable doubt, but as far as the civil trial standard of preponderance of evidence, it certainly has more chances to be the right state than the Pfeiffian anti-Pfeiffian state. But at the end of the day, you as jury, it's for you to decide. Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
So for the particle force symmetry you mentioned, it's unitary symmetry or anti-unitary symmetry?
Anti-unitary symmetry.
Just like time reversal.
It's essentially time reversal. Well, technically it's defined in the following way. You fill fully the first Landau level and then populate it with holes. So it's anti-unitary. And it's very much like time reversal.
I see. So when you act it on the coefficient of the wave function, you actually need to take a complex conjugate.
Yes, if you wish. You can, well, subtlety is that that's the wave function for the holes and not for the electrons. But yes. Essentially it is. So it's, again, it's slightly subtler than that because you also need to fill fully the first Landau level. But other than that, you're right. And that imposes huge restrictions on the topological order. So almost no topological orders would be compatible with that. But the pH Pfeiffian topological order survives that complex conjugation. Because when you complex conjugate things, you change the sign of all statistical phases. And normally you would get a completely different set. It's very non-trivial that you get the same set. Yes?
Okay, so there's two questions. One is you wrote on a schematic wave function for the particle symmetric. How does that do with respect to bulk energy?
I don't know. I didn't do any numerics. Moreover, I'm not confident that numerics is going to be very useful because its predictions for the gaps are so much off what actually happens that, well, what's the point? But I didn't try. It's a complicated wave function, unfortunately. It has an integral on it. It's not that easy to even verify that thing. It's almost the same. You just change the direction of the Majorana. The crazy thing is that it didn't occur to anyone for 20 years. But that's all you do. Anti-Pfeiffian is a big difference. Anti-Pfeiffian is a particle hole conjugated of Pfeiffian, which means that you... Which means pretty complicated thing. It has a complicated structure. You have a charge mode and then three Majoranas running in the opposite direction. Here only one. So the difference is more significant. But in some way you can get it from anti-Pfeiffian with the same procedure. Because what happens with this particle hole edge is its own particle hole conjugate. So you use the same procedure you apply to the Pfeiffian state to obtain anti-Pfeiffian and verify that nothing changes. That's a very non-trivial restriction. That's the only state for that's the only edge theory for which we could see that this happens. Yes?
For my understanding, it seems like you try to propose some kind of non-trivial SET state for this.
Sorry, what did you
say? Symmetry enriched topological order.
It's not really symmetry protected.
Yeah, but I mean, for this particular state.
It's not symmetry protected, so I would put it the following way. So you don't need symmetry to have that state. In fact, I didn't discuss this in my talk, but you see this on the transparency. I expect the state to be present only when you have no exact particle hole symmetry. And what I neglected to tell, you have approximate particle hole symmetry at 1/2, but you definitely have none of it at 5/2. So my expectation is actually that in a paradoxical way, the absence of the particle hole symmetry generate this state. But clearly, its ground state cannot have particle hole symmetry if the Hamiltonian doesn't. What happens is much, much subtler. What happens is the topological order compatible with the symmetry, not protected by the symmetry. There is no protection and there is no symmetry, but compatible, which means that the set of quasiparticles and their abusion and braiding rules doesn't change after you apply the particle hole symmetry transformation. That's a much subtler thing. It's not symmetry protected or even symmetry enhanced state. It's something different. I would call it symmetry from no symmetry.
Right. It's kind of emergent symmetry.
it's not even symmetry, because there is no symmetry. There is only compatibility with symmetry. I am not claiming that the energies of plus and minus E over 4 particles are the same as the particle Hall symmetry would demand. They are probably different. I am claiming, however, that their braiding phases manage to be such that you do the particle Hall transformation and you have some pair of particles, and it manages to be mapped onto another pair of particles whose braiding phases is exactly minus what you had initially. So it's a non-trivial constraint. And what's crazy here is how it arrives. All I really demand to construct the theory is that the thermal conductance and the electrical conductance don't change after I do particle Hall symmetry. After I did that, miraculously, I automatically get that all the braiding phases have the same property, just as a consequence of the thermal conductance being correct.
Yes. Yeah, so my point is that if you just look at this huge algebra of this
unit model
category
theory,
there's kind of some
yeah, yes, right. The fusion and braiding algebra has a symmetry. But the ground state and the excited states don't. But the fusion and algebra does have it. So that's what happens. So it's pretty strange, but then it's inevitable in quantum Hall effect, because nothing is symmetry protected in the quantum Hall effect. If you have a certain state and you change the Hamiltonian slightly, the state is not going away, even though you kill the symmetry. But what I'm addressing is the opposite phenomenon that wasn't discussed before, but which happens. Even though you never need symmetry to have something, it may happen that symmetry definitely excludes something. That if you have the particle Hall symmetry, that neither of the proposed previously states is possible. And so the claim is that in some way I am adiabatically connected to that situation, even though I don't have symmetry. And that immediately excludes all other proposals, which are certainly actually excluded by experiment.
Any other questions? I have a question.
Yeah.
So from purely theoretical construction, actually I can construct all kinds of edge theories. Like you have one charge mode and a bunch of other Marron modes, like several propagating modes and several other counterpropagating Marron modes. Like it's basically, so in principle you know that there are 16 different ways of freeing the Freeman theory, right? So have you ever actually thought about that in terms of your argument that this particle closing, this pH Fabian is the most like is the most probable state in terms of
well that's the simple thing I can write down. It has the right thermal conductance. It's important. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But thermal Hall conductance is never measured. I think here your starting point is that you want the system to be, if the system is particle symmetric, then you arrive at the end, you got this state. But because there's no exact particle symmetry. So for example, I just look at the tunnel experiment and measure this exponent, and I want to compare the pH Fabian state and with some other imaginary states and compare with them. Is there any argument?
Well, I think my logic was somewhat different. So my starting point was really Son's paper. In retrospect, it seems trivial just to invert that Majorana mode, but no one ever did that because of a certain dogma in the business. First of all, well, just empty inventing of quantum Hall states is, well, self-defeating business. You can invent very many of them, so what? And second, there was some dogma that you write down correlation functions of chiral conformal field theories. Why? No one could explain. In fact, people never do that in a billion particle Hall conjugated states. They do something very different. So here you can use exactly the same procedure people used to construct the state state filling factor to sort, but now to a non-abelian state. Why not? So there was some dogma here, but my logic was different. So my logic was starting from Son's idea, which is very bright and seems to describe everything that happens at 1/2 correctly. And then he tells that if you believe this idea, that what happens at 5/2 in terms of those Dirac fermions is ridiculously simple, it's just S-pairing. And we know that almost all superconductors are S-pairing. And we know that neither of the 10 proposals I showed are S-pairing. There are so many of them, in part because of that self-duality, that for each state you can build a particle Hall symmetric conjugate. So immediately you have twice as many proposals compared to any filling factor. But the other problem is that all these ways to pair particles are relatively complicated. And when you're in the business of doing complicated things, there are many of them. And here you just have a sparing. That's so beautiful. And his claim is that, okay, because of this particle hole symmetry, I have a sparing. So my job was actually trying to understand, okay, how I can get the states that would agree with the properties of his state. And he could not tell much about his state, but he could tell the shift, he could tell the electrical conductance, he could tell the thermal conductance just from the symmetry considerations. When I tried to construct such state, it turned out that's extremely restricted. But I can build such state, and that's it. It has all the properties of some state made by a sparing of those fermions, and it seems to agree with all experiment in contrast to all other states. So that was the logic.
Then let's thank Dimas' very entertaining talk.